This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Thank you very much, Mark. We're going to speed along now and shift focus on to English language. I'd like to invite David Gradol to take the stage. David is director of the English Company and a good friend of Cambridge English and many others in the English language firmament. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Saul. And I'm really sort of hesitate to say good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I should just say hello world. I want to start with an experience I had just recently. I've just come back from Hong Kong and I was at the student protest. This is how it looked about 10 days ago. You will have been following it, no doubt, in the news. What I find has not been perhaps fully reported in the West is the extent to which this is a student protest. It's almost like a classic 1960s, about 50 years on. It's led by students, even secondary school students. One of the student leaders is 17 years old. And it started with a boycott of lectures amongst students. And they sat around on the grass outside the government buildings, holding lectures about politics, about all kinds of things. It was almost the kind of agenda that they perhaps wished they had been getting in the universities. And even the Occupy Central movement was led by and is led by faculty, by academics. So this is quite a student movement. And it's people who are profoundly disturbed and concerned about their future. This particular trigger was about the form of elections for the next chief executive and the future of democracy in Hong Kong. But actually, their concern has been building up over many years and is much wider. It's about a threat to their very identity and their future. And within this context is something to do with their university teaching and language. The language of their identity in Hong Kong, for example, is they're increasingly integrated with mainland China. Just to give you a little example, only last week, one lecturer in Hong Kong University was attacked by a mainland student who was complaining that he was teaching through English and not Chinese. So what seems to be an inevitable push towards English as a medium of instruction at universities is perhaps not quite so universal as we might think. And we need to remember that. But this protest has perhaps been one of the most filmed, reported of any in recent times. This is just one bridge showing some of the international media. And the students know this. They are talking not just to the government, to the world. And they put up notices in English to speak to the world. So they're very much aware of the importance of English. But I want to talk a little bit more about English in the universities. I'll be focusing on the universities for the moment, but there is a strong articulation between what happens in the universities and at tertiary level and what happens in the school system. And it's working in both directions. There is a kind of washback effect from the universities as the school systems try and produce school leavers who are competitive for entry to universities, but also as more schools improve their English teaching, universities in different parts of the world are finding that their intake, and this is particularly true in Europe, their intake is of students who are much better than their predecessors in English. Now, we know the story, I'm sure all of us of recent years, of the growth of English medium instruction, EMI. I'm not entirely happy about that term, but let's just sort of keep it for the moment. But one point I'd like to make is that the motivation behind this is very different, has been very different, in different parts of the world. So within Europe, we've had our recent history of the Bologna process, for example, and now the European higher education area, which has somehow certainly, if not directly promoting the use of English, has encouraged the use of English medium courses because of the way that that can encourage student mobility. In Japan, on the other hand, where now about 25% of universities offer English medium courses, the driver has been less for international students. There's not been a terribly large flow of international students into Japan, but it's been more about preparing domestic students for the global world and for employment in the global world. China, on the other hand, is currently one of the things it's doing with English is repositioning itself as a destination for international students. And we have an increasing number of universities teaching English medium courses in engineering, medical colleges, law, and so on. And we need to watch those numbers. It tells us an interesting story. So we have this big diversity, which perhaps we are in danger of forgetting, because we appear to be overtaken by a new kind of agenda. I've seen a number of shifts going on in the kind of motivation for English medium and the way people talk about it. For example, English medium courses, particularly in Europe but elsewhere as well, used to be kind of bottom-up decisions. They were about departments or even individual teachers wanting to develop English medium courses. They were done usually with a certain amount of sort of time, if not funding, to work out what would work. Now we're getting decisions are being made at a higher level. They're perhaps at university president level, or perhaps the Ministry of Education, or even sort of the national presidential decree or royal decree. So we're seeing a kind of shift that's been from a kind of idealistic, if you like, social motives to a much more market-oriented one, which talks about competition, creates league tables, for example, and is interested in the revenue that international students can provide, rather than the intellectual capital and excitement that international students can provide a campus. And we also, I think, see this as part of a wider shift in discourse from education as a public good to education as a commodity which can be traded. So we can really talk about that in a shorthand, very simply, as the emergence of a very strong neoliberal agenda focusing on education. And when you see the amount of public funding that's going in now to education around the world, you can see why there are people out there in the corporate world who are very keen to get their hands on some of that cash. And the means by which it's done are complex, but I think we need to be aware of what's going on and make sure that what is happening actually fits our agenda and not just theirs. I'm not preaching against private education or even education for profit. But what is happening in its relation to English, I think, is something that we need to look at critically. Now, we have, historically, in recent years, we have had a kind of major issue about the quality of incoming students, particularly in Britain. Is their English good enough? So tests like IELTS are used to screen them. And by and large, what has emerged is a kind of a magic level of C1, if you like, the Common European Framework of Reference, as the minimum level for any student who needs to engage seriously with academic material at tertiary level. Now, when I was doing some research recently for a Cambridge assessment in the Pearl River Delta in South China, including Hong Kong, I was looking at IELTS results. And you'll find this chart actually in the book, which is available free of charge, not in good bookshops, but free of charge on the Cambridge website, with a sort of commentary about this. Because we have a curve there from mainland China, for example, which are mainly students aspiring to go overseas. That's a very rapidly increasing trend from China. But if you look at it, Only a small proportion are really safely above that C1 level. So what do universities do? They're very, very keen to have these Chinese students and bringing their fees with them. And there has been in the past really some kind of very mixed experiences. I think what we've seen in Britain develop in recent years is something really very worth looking at from elsewhere in the world, which is the system of kind of pathways and foundation courses, some of which are really very good. When I looked at them recently, I was surprised at how things had developed in just certainly the last sort of 5 years or so. But these pathways, these foundation courses are expensive, and they're adding another year into effectively an undergraduate degree, turning it into a four-year degree. If we look at Hong Kong, though, it looks at first sight as if the distribution of Hong proficiency in Hong Kong students is higher than that of the mainland. But, and this is a warning about all league tables of this kind, we need to remember that in Hong Kong, most of those students are actually taking it, the test, in their final year. The government has a scheme which pays for the fees for any student in Hong Kong who wishes to take IELTS. I think about two-thirds of them do, because if they have it on their transcript, it helps their employability. But what sort of rather disturbed me was that the proportion of these Hong Kong students who in their final year were still falling below the C1 barrier. This suggests that they've gone through their English medium courses at university level, never actually reaching the C1 level that we're all saying is necessary for proper academic engagement. Now, I'm just picking out Hong Kong because I know the area quite well. I've taught in the university there, and I have the data. This is a familiar problem, though, to anyone, I think, across the world who is teaching courses in English at the moment. What do you do about this problem where you're teaching students whose English is not really quite good enough? Now, what we know from recent research is that students with low levels of English or insufficient levels of English become marginalized in the learning process. They're not enabled to follow lectures without making notes all the time that they can sort of hopefully look back at later. They can't engage in discussions freely. They can't follow what the questions that their colleagues are asking. And so gradually you get this kind of dumbing down, as it were, of students who are going through, perhaps even bright students, through an English medium experience. Now, this is not just something which is happening out in developing economies or a long way away. This kind of report is coming in, say, from Sweden, which is regarded in Europe as having some of the highest levels of English amongst its students. And recent interest in these problems have now shifted to the university teachers, to the faculty, to the lecturers, because part of the whole logic of internationalisation is that you're able to bring in teaching staff from all over the world, and by allowing them to teach through English, you can benefit from these international perspectives. But if they're not able to communicate in English, well, then, again, we have a problem. Now, I have to sort of move on quickly here because we're running out of time. But I just wanted to say this, by the way, is a democracy wall that the students have put up. And if you look at the language mix of the wall here, it's very typical to the university environment as well. It's mainly Chinese. It's not much in English. What I want to focus for as a kind of takeaway here is that internationalization in its current form and the role of English medium instruction is coming under very close scrutiny now, as never before. Researchers are looking at it, policymakers are looking at it, economists are looking at it. We have a complex agenda around English now, and we need to be much clearer, I think, about why and how we are sort of using English. We, as professionals engaged particularly in English language education, need to provide an informed and critical voice rather than be seen simply as promoting English medium instruction at any cost. I'll be very happy to take questions on this later. Thank you very much.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.